Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hi, and welcome to New Books in Genocide Studies, part of the New Books Network podcast. My name is Kelly McFall from Newman University, and I'm the host of the show. Every month or so, I interview an author of a new or recent book in genocide studies. Today, I'm thrilled to welcome Abdelwahab El Effendi to the show. Abdelwahab is a reader in politics at Westminster University in the United Kingdom and the editor of a fascinating new book, Genocidal Nightmares, Narratives of Insecurity and the Logic of Mass Atrocity. The book offers both a coherent, stimulating thesis and a wide variety of authors and case studies, and makes it all pull together into a nice package, something that's enormously challenging to pull off. It lays out a compelling case for the importance of narratives in the production of mass violence. I'm thrilled to be able to talk with Abdelwahab about it today. So with that, thanks for being with us on New Books in Genocide Studies, and welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for having me.
So why don't we start? I'd like to give you a chance to tell us a little bit about your background and how you came to be interested in studying mass violence.
Yes, thank you very much. I am actually Sudanese by origin, so that's sufficient. Mm-hmm. But I've been living in the UK since 1982. And while I was completing my MA and PhD here, I was also editing a magazine. I was a managing editor of a magazine called Arabia, a monthly, which used to cover Muslim affairs. And it was in that capacity that I was introduced to the Balkans the hard way. We used to cover Eastern Europe and Central Asia. And then one day I received a visit from an angry Bosnian delegation who were very unhappy that we were covering Bosnia from Croatian sources. And at that time, I, of course, had no clue about these complications, but we used to have communiques from an organization called itself the Croatian Muslim Association. And it turned out that this was a cover for a nationalist Croatian group, which was claiming Bosnia, of course. And so I was introduced to these complications and the way identity people try to give others identities they don't want. And that was really bizarre. However, the I think the Balkan contribution for us has come from Markovic, my dear friend Slobodan Markovic, who was my colleague in the, we used to have a summer school in Belgrade. The Center for Study of Democracy, which I work, and his organization there used to do it every year. And he was such an insightful person about these things.
So you chose political science. You're a reader in politics. Why that discipline?
That's interesting, because my original discipline was philosophy, actually. I graduated in philosophy. I did my MA thesis studying Karl Marx and his attitude to philosophy. And I think that convinced me that philosophy is not, that politics is a more fruitful kind of thing to do. So I tend to do in politics.
So I always like origin stories of books. And in the introduction or preface or foreword, whatever it is here, you point out that this book has been kind of in gestation, or at least the ideas behind it, you've been thinking about since the early 1990s. How did this book come about?
Yeah, I think that the idea about the book is really disarmingly simple. Mm-hmm. We encounter it every day, which is when watching a movie, for example, and you see some rough, muscular man meets a little pretty girl on the beach and then immediately start attacking her, killing her, cutting her to pieces, driving a sharp object through her heart, burning her, and then you see, look at this, how awful. It's really repugnant. But if you have the narratives in the narrative, just the sequence before was telling you how, for example, this vampire or evil cyborg has actually attacked that girl earlier, and now is taking her shape and trying to do evil things, then you look at this as a heroic kind of saving of mankind from this evil thing. So I think this idea about how narratives could change how you view violence had been there, but I think I came to it through a tortuous route, because I was, when we set up this program here in the mid-1990s, I was puzzled by something in the Middle East, which is that we have a lot of terrorist activities going on, and we also have despotic regimes all over. And from my study of terrorism, this is not supposed to happen. You are supposed to have terrorism in democracies. I mean, I think of the theorists actually define terrorism as some attacks in the context of democracy. So how come, and of course we know why that's the case. I mean, you cannot blackmail people like Stalin or even Putin mm-hmm. by saying that I'm going to kill nice, innocent people and you have to know what I say. So why is this the case in the Arab Middle East? And I think I came across a solution by looking at some of the narratives of the people engaged in this. And I found, for example, that when people like Hafez al-Assad, for example, commit genocide in Hama, they have a narrative which shows that this is not only a threat to his regime, which is correct, but also to his Alawite community and also to the Arab world and to the resistance. And this same rhetoric now is being used by his son Bashar. Mm-hmm. Similarly, I looked at narratives, for example, of some of the violent groups in Egypt. And their also explanation is that they have heard about the terrible torture which people who are arrested in the Egyptian jails endure. And they decided that's better for them to die than be captured. Hmm. So they try to engage. So this is where I found this idea of narrative of insecurity and its immediate effect on causing mm-hmm. these atrocities. And then, of course, I looked at Darfur. It was also a similar thing. So I began from that on to look at, to explore this program more. And the more I explored it, the more I found that this is how we can explain this sometimes sudden shift towards mm-hmm. Mass violence.
So you mentioned the idea of narratives of insecurity, and I want to come back to that in just a second. But before we get there, in genocide studies and broadly speaking in studies of terrorism and violence, there's kind of it's very typical to hear a lot of emphasis on definitions. And without getting bogged down too much in that, how are you defining these objects that you are studying? You say mass atrocities. What is it that you're trying to explain?
I think one of the significant contribution, I think, in the book is defining mass violence, because mm-hmm. we have encountered that people try to define mass violence usually by looking at numbers. And I think that's an unfruitful kind of approach. We define mass violence in terms of where the evidence points to the fact that the perpetrator doesn't have an upper limit on victims that they are prepared to destroy in order to achieve their objective. That would make, for example, killing 5 people or 10 people or 100,000, because some atrocities, just a few people are killed. And we can see, for example, from clear evidence that, for example, the terrorists of 9/11 had no limit. They did not have a limit on how many victims they wanted. Or, for example, Bashar Assad now in Syria doesn't have any limit on whether direct or collateral damage. And there was no care taken to protect civilians. So I think atrocity in this regard is that violence where people just do not care, which I think is probably the best definition of an atrocity, which is also intuitive as well.
Mm-hmm. And one of the really nice things about your book is that the explanatory framework you use can apply whether you're talking about instances of terrorism or of massive violence or traditionally defined or genocide. So could you explain a little bit what exactly you mean by the narratives of insecurity?
Briefly, it's scare stories. I mean, people who construct these stories project a kind of dire threat, which is imminent and present and real. And they frame the argument to the people in this language, which will then play on the fears of the people. You can find, for example, people speaking about, we started with the story of the Norwegian perpetrator of the massacre of Oslo, who had this narrative that Muslim hordes are there to take over Europe. We heard this before about immigration. We heard it about Jews. We can hear it about blacks. We hear it about lower class people. All sorts of these stories, which are coherent, which are also plausible in some sense. It is usually just a scare story, which is being bandied around.
So where do these narratives come from?
I think there are a number of sources. There is usually prejudice. People are usually have their own prejudices in societies. But we found in this research, for example, that intellectuals sometimes are a source of these stories, because these stories have to be told in a very coherent way. I mean, it's just not a... you can hear, for example, racist remarks from the man in the street. You can hear prejudices from old ladies. But in order for these to become a real score story, you have to have a credible source, a politician, a maverick agitator. It could be from a sustained source, like, for example, a right-wing group or a political group or a group of intellectuals. But I think what is interesting in these times And especially, for example, look at the Yugoslav story. Mm-hmm. It was the intellectuals, actually, who did construct very plausible narratives, which had laid the ground for the shift. And for example, these days, Islamophobic narratives come from very respectable intellectuals.
Mm-hmm.
And I think one of the interesting elements in the Yugoslav case was that the intellectuals who produced these narratives were themselves former left-wing Marxists.
Mm-hmm.
So they were able to inoculate these narratives against possible criticism from that area by showing that, for example, we were, for example, good Yugoslavs, we were good nationalists, we were good universalists, but we discovered correctly that this universalism is just a one-way street. Mm-hmm. We are the only, the Serbs, for example, or the Croats are the only universalists, but everybody else is a nationalist, so we have to look out for ourselves.
So you've hinted at this a little bit, but could you expand on this? So you've got this production of the narrative by intellectuals or other people. How is it that some narratives take off and others kind of die without ever getting any significant support or acceptance?
I think the, for example, we have a famous example of a narrative which died. That was the famous Rivers of Blood speech by Enoch Powell here in England in 1968. Now, that was a narrative which first took off like wildfire. And a lot of observers at that time thought that Britain, if that narrative has been allowed to go on, Britain would have probably become an early Serbia. Now, I think there, the British political elite, especially Edward Heath, the leader of the Conservative Party at that time, took really decisive action and ostracized Powell. Also, the media and the British intellectuals in general played a very constructive role. It depends on overall context. If narratives find no resistance, they are usually they go through the area of least resistance, that they play on prejudices. We see, for example, examples of Islamophobia these days. It is moving fast, but it's also being countered by politicians, by intellectuals, by mainstream media. And so it is being contained. But we could see a situation where it could actually take off, especially if we have corroborating evidence, like, for example, this horrendous act by these militant groups like Islamic State and so on and so on. I think in Yugoslavia, the breakdown of the whole order and the breakdown of the state and the breakdown of the, also similarly in Rwanda, usually when the whole political order, the whole social order collapses, it can be easier. In Nazi Germany, for example, it was the state which was promoting them. That was an easy explanation there. But still, of course, we have to have intellectuals, we have to have media. But I think the role of the intellectuals is usually a very important role.
So then what advantages does this focus on narratives of insecurity offer in understanding this kind of violence?
I said about the movie, it shows that you don't have to be a different person, or you don't have to be crazy, you don't have to be psychopath in order to shift into this direction. Because if there's a convincing narrative to tell you, for example, that Muslims are a danger to Europe, they are going to take over, they are going to introduce barbarism and so on and so on. And credible intellectuals, credible voices telling you that, then the next step would be, in the Norwegian case, some people would say the next argument is that the politicians, the leaders are not doing what they should do. And that's where terrorism, for example, comes from. Terrorism comes when there is a narrative, as in the Arab case, saying that, for example, the Israelis are oppressing us, Americans are doing this, and the Americans are doing this. And even the politicians and the leaders say this, but then they are doing nothing about it. Similarly, if you have in Europe the politicians speaking about immigration, about foreigners, about aliens, but they are doing nothing about it, then you got the movements to say, let us do something about it. And then you get the right-wing extremist groups, you get the individual terrorists, and so on and so on. So the way narratives shape your world, you don't need all these other explanations, which try to find, for example, that individuals must have had some psychological problems, they must have things in their childhood, they must have, it must be poverty, it must be this, it must be that. You don't need all these explanations. You know that a rational being confronted with this kind of narratives, with this construction of the world, will see it as normal and even imperative that you have to do this, that we have to move on. And the others who don't move, you regard them as people who are blind, who are being bought, are not doing their duty, and so on and so on. So the narrative approach is a very clear and very cogent explanation and doesn't have put you in the loops of trying to find why, for example, do these nice, ordinary middle class people suddenly turn into murderers. Mm-hmm.
So a couple days ago, I was interviewing Irvin Staub for a podcast that will appear, or from the time this one will show up, has appeared a week or so ago, on his book Overcoming Evil. And I asked him about the title and about the idea that the actions of these perpetrators are evil. How do you see that question about the more, let me put it this way. Is it the responsibility of academics to evaluate the moral quality of these behaviors, or just to explain how and why they happen?
No, I think it is. You cannot, omit this evaluation. I mean, mm-hmm. It doesn't make it less evil if it is explicable. I think we should mm-hmm. that explanation. Yes, does show us. Does remove some of the mystery about it. It might also appear to remove some of the responsibility. But I think the one point we have looked at, which is as I mentioned, that the balance between structure and agency, the narratives. The narrative explanation makes it applicable that people had made a choice to believe certain stories, to accept them and to embrace them. So it's not something that is you are psychotic or you are not in control of you. You have either chosen to believe this narrative or you have either constructed them yourself. And I think there are several levels of this. There are people who construct these narratives in some sincerity, that they really believe that there are problems. Mm-hmm. And there are majority who actually construct these narratives in order, for example, to further an agenda. they might not be wanting to things to go to genocide, but they just, for example, want to shore up their regime, or they want to scare their followers into following them. But then it could lead to that. So there is there are people who choose to believe these stories, and there are people who choose to resist them. And there are people who construct these stories, and there are people who disseminate them, and there are people who actually uncritically accept them. And so there is an element here of agency. You are not being driven by some unknown forces or by demons or whatever. And I think this demystifies it, but also shows that you have a responsibility for what you have done. It's you cannot discount this.
Editors are in an awkward position sometimes in interviews like this, of being asked to talk about essays that they read and they kind of critiqued, but they didn't write. And it's unfair to ask you to talk about too many of them, but I would like to ask you about a couple of the case studies in the book, maybe three if we have time, and start with your own, since that's probably the easiest to talk about. And we were chatting a little bit before the interview about the fact that as somebody trained in history who's picked up a little bit of international relations theory on the side, I had to teach myself about the Copenhagen School and reading this. Can you talk a little bit about what is kind of a meld of an introductory essay, but also a case study in your book? Talk about this theory of securitization and how you use that in this book.
Yes. Yes, actually, securitization theory, one of its authors, Barry Buzan, was a colleague of ours here at the department. And so we had a lot of deep discussion about these things. But I think what I pick about securitization theory, which in part shares with us the idea that these narratives or the speech act about is the ground of insecurity, that you construct insecurity through speech. But I think my main objection and also attempt to develop the theory further was that this theory assumes and takes for granted a democratic background. That the conversation they speak about can only take place and have the effect they mention in a democratic atmosphere. And they are in denial about this, in fact, although they mention in several of their works that they of course, assume democratization at least, making it the starting point. They claim that this theory works in also non-democratic contexts, and they have case studies about China and others which try to prove this. And I think the point I have made, especially with regard to this, that securitization theory would not explain atrocities. Because if you are talking about democratic theory, or democratic atmosphere, and democratic debates about security, yes, of course, a number of the people I quoted mentioned the securitization of immigration and similar things, which they see as dangerous and even bordering on genocide. But it doesn't look plausible. So I thought that we need to look at levels of securitization, that there is a level of securitization which is healthy and acceptable, which societies need. And there is a level which I call hyper-securitization, where you really go berserk about this. And so we have to look then at also regime types according to securitization. That liberal democracies, a lot of theorists of securitization theory, and some of the critics, for example, Camden, speak about liberal democracies as if they are Nazi regimes, which is a little bit over the top. I think I'll define liberal democracies as minimal, by definition, minimal securitization regimes, because they think that we should allow more liberty, which means that they don't see a lot of things as threats. And then you have authoritarian regimes, which are maximum securitization regimes, and then you have genocidal regimes, which are called hyper-securitization regimes. So we need to develop, yet the theory is adequate for looking at securitization within democracies or semi-democracies, because they explain how we construct danger and how we could move certain issues, for example, like immigration, from just a policy issue to a security issue, and so on. But we need a little bit of development to move towards a to explain genocide and mass violence. You need to go to we introduce a new term of hyper-securitization, which is when really berserk narratives of insecurity, like the ones, for example, produced by regimes like Assad's, for example, which purposes, I could look, for example, at a very apt example in Egypt, for example. We had a maximum securitization regime in Mubarak time, where, for example, all opposition was seen as a danger to the regime and to the international security, and any opponent will be suppressed. Now we had, when we moved to the Arab Spring, all this disappeared. Everybody was happy in the spring, and Islamists and Christians, everybody was was secure about each other. There was no fear. Now we move to Sisi time, which looks like a hyper-securitization move, where the very existence of Islamists is seen as a danger. And mainstream Islamist groups are described as terrorists. And you could see here how these things happen, how, for example, Nazi Germany happened, how Rwanda happened, in the sense that people create insecurity in this way, because if you treat everybody as enemy, then probably everybody becomes an enemy. And so on, that comes to that situation. So you can see how this works.
So your essay is at least a bit theoretical. Alex DeWall's essay on the Sudan is a little bit more historical. Can you talk about the narratives that characterize the debate in the Sudan and the way in which the Sudanese people received and selected which narratives they were going to believe?
Yes, I think Alex speaks also of a very what he called the civility and barbarity paradox in Sudan, which is also very, very interesting, in the sense that, yes, you find that narratives of insecurity has been rampant. Some of it were ethnic, like in the North South, but we had also Islamist and left-wing narratives. In the coup, for example, of 1969 was perpetrated. There was the left-wing were saying that the country is going to go to the dog, this reactionary, and so on and so on. That's the usual thing. So they arrested, they killed, they did whatever they do. Then everything was forgotten. And then the Islamists came and also did the same, that Sudan is being threatened and so on, Arab identity. But I think that the point which Alex looks at is that the elite in Sudan are cozy with each other, in spite of these interesting, and he tries to explain this by saying that actually most of the fighting happens in the periphery, where the elite are in the safety of their cities, are unaffected. So they can afford to exaggerate and play up the danger for the benefits of these people who are fighting. But they themselves, for example, would go to dinner with the same guys whom they describe as devil to their followers. And they have a nice time and all of them. And he, I think this is a phenomenon which has been observed about Sudan and needs a little bit more study.
Yeah, I was really fascinated by his suggestion that what's, and I'm imposing my words on rather than his, and maybe that's unfair, by the sense that the actors in the Sudan are kind of the ultimate Machiavellians who are always looking out, or that's not fair, who take a distinctly political view of behaviors rather than assuming that there's something intrinsic about the people sitting across from them that make them friends or enemies.
Yes, I wouldn't go that far. I think they are torn in a sense.
Okay.
They are Sudan had a long history of coexistence. These elites have usually gone to school together in the colonial era when there was a very small number of schools and or were in the army together. And so they are real friends of each other. But, of course, in the meantime, the interests of their constituencies have diverged quite widely. And I think they are torn between maintaining this kind of old order on the personal level and working out. And I think sometimes they also produce narratives which run ahead of them. They can very easily make a sort of wild claims, which some politicians make as kind of exaggeration. They do not believe it, but maybe their followers and many others believe them. And then they go there, and then they fight, and then they come and reconcile, and we had peace deals and all these things. And there's a kind of what you call nihilism or kind of really uselessness about all this, pointless.
So one of the observations I hear you saying is that in fact narratives, and this loops back to an earlier point in our conversation, narratives might be generated by elites or other people, but in fact the events on the ground that narratives inspire can actually change the narrative itself beyond what the initial authors of the narrative expected it to be or to serve.
I think that's putting it really accurately, yes. I think the narratives then have a life of their own. And also groups which are formed around these narratives, they also then produce more self-reinforcing narratives. If you if people started killing each other after they were neighbors, for example, like in Darfur, people who were always neighbors and always living peacefully with each other, then they start killing each other. Of course, that has a backlash because then the insecurity deepens, and then you sometimes they need stories to justify what they have done, things they themselves recognize as really atrocious and unacceptable when you go and kill your neighbors. So they then produce stories about some foreign conspiracies, about the other side being instigated by some evildoers from so and so. And then this become reinforced. I talked, for example, to one of the so-called Arab gathering in Darfur. And he was one of the credited for creating, starting some of this Arab, non-Arab thing. And when I talked to him, he was just a simple guy. And he said, you know, all I wanted was to get a job. He said that the ministries were given to other people and none of our group has given were given ministry. So I issued this communique to say that the Arabs have been so and so sidelined and marginalized. And he said, we got three jobs and ministries and we're happy. And that was the end of it. Of course, that was not the end of it for everybody else. And so, yes, you can have these very mundane concerns. then bringing other consequences, which this guy didn't actually think about when he was doing what he was doing. Huh.
What a story! That's a fascinating story. Let's shift to a third essay, which talks well. So it's the essay about Yugoslavia that Slobodan Marković writes, which is a wonderful essay and very rich. And I just wanted, and we can talk about it more if you'd like. But specifically, I'd like to talk about this idea of narratives driven by statistics or arguments about statistics, about relative loss or about how many people were killed or saved or whatever. Can you talk a little bit about those debates over statistics?
That's very interesting because the debate in Yugoslavia has revolved around these atrocities and counter-atrocities. Mm-hmm. And there was this Serb prisoner camps during the Nazi occupation, which Croats were accused of manning and helping. And there were then the massacres of Croats after the war by the communist insurgents. And in both cases, it has become a matter of how many were. And each side began to inflate the numbers on their side, while trying to actually minimize or even deny that anything has happened to the other side. And so that was really intriguing, that numbers became a kind of driver for narratives. But this is not actually isolated. For example, in Darfur, the issue of numbers has become also quite crucial for the there has been, Mahmoud Mamdani in his book on Darfur, Saviors and Survivors, tried, of course, to play the other side and see that the numbers were inflated and so on and so on. But this became part of the debate itself, and it's not. We know, of course, about the denial of the Holocaust and the numbers. Also, this is a figure which is also become a feature. So I think this is usually part of these debates, that the people who are on the perpetrator side or have sympathy with perpetrators try usually to play down the numbers. But yes, I think for me, I think although I'm not expert in Yugoslavia, but mm-hmm. I've read a lot about it, and as I told you, I had been following it from the 1980s. But I think it was very insightful the way Slobodan has shown, for example, how this thing has been going on since the 1960s, the way there were these communist prominent intellectual on both sides, on the Croat side and on the Serb side, who have developed these narratives. And began, for example, to produce books just as the Yugoslav communist state was in twilight. And the way, and this again explains how this narrative, the Serb book was published, and they just printed, I think, 2,000 or 3,000 copies. Mm-hmm. But they were immediately sold out, and then another print, and suddenly it became a bestseller. The same thing happened with Tuchman's book, which is interesting. But I think what is interesting also on the Serb side is that it was not actually Milosevic who started this, but the intellectuals. Milosevic then benefits from it. While on the Croat side, Tuchman, the intellectual, also became the leader, which is quite interesting in that. But it is really fascinating about how these things evolve and then get a life of their own. I don't think, for example, the guy who wrote the book anticipated this kind of reception and creating a movement, but that happened, which is something also we need to look at, how the mechanism happened by which sometimes you cannot predict the impact of these narratives and how they go.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's back out maybe from talking about specific essays to talk about some broader questions. And the first is probably both the most obvious and maybe the most difficult to answer, and that's, how do we take these ideas of narratives, or this insights provided by the idea of narratives of insecurity, and apply them in a practical way?
I think the first thing is that this is a clear early warning system. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. If you watch the narratives, if you watch the stories, then you can see how things are going to follow. Usually, there is a long lag between the stories and the actual violence. Mm-hmm. And one example I have noted, for example, in Egypt, since the beginning of 2012, there was a kind of really ugly narrative, which you see in the media. Mm-hmm. Demonization, hate, real, real ugliness. And for the general observers who do not see the link, they might look at this case as it's really sad, it's really... But I think the lesson from our book is that these things should not be seen in this just trivial way. That the first stage usually in the genocide is the demonization, the portrayal of the other as a threat, the creation of this fear, of this hate, and then it becomes reinforcing, self-reinforcing, that the man on the street, for example, when he or she heard the story many times, would themselves then be in fear from what happened. And then mm-hmm. they might begin to conduct themselves in a fearful way. And this becomes contagious. And then at one point, things just get out of hand. And then it will be too difficult And again, I look at the example, for example, of even in Yugoslavia itself, for example, the role of the intellectuals. Mm-hmm. In Bosnia, for example, the role of Izet Begovic as the leader of mm-hmm. the Muslims there. He managed to produce a more balanced, a more restrained kind of narrative, which was taken by the people, kept them from engaging into atrocities or mass atrocities. And so you can see the role leaders or intellectuals or the international community can play into when they see these early warning signs encountering them. So I think the first is early warning signs. Mm-hmm. The second is the role of intellectuals in encountering the ugly narratives by producing also counter narratives and more restrained narratives, and also courageous sometimes narratives, because usually when these things start, and again in Egypt this has become the case, that anybody who tries to counter the narratives would immediately find themselves, demonize themselves, ostracized, and even in prison. So it is not an easy thing, but there is a crucial role, I think, for intellectuals in this.
So a couple questions that maybe on the surface are about the project, but maybe I hope have broader significance. And the first is, that you work in politics and international relations, but it seems like, at least from what you say in the book, that you really intentionally intended the authors of these essays to come from a wide variety of disciplines. Well, why did you think this was important?
Yes, I think for our from our perspective, since we are looking at narratives, first we wanted people who are aware of the kind of narratives which are being told and circulated either prior to violence or during it or after it. And for this reason, we had people from the countries involved who understand the languages and also have been following the history. A lot of them are also experts in literary criticism and literature, which is also significant. The Peace from Nigeria in particular was very insightful in the way it has managed to find out how narratives circulated mainly by leaders have led to this kind of polarization in the country. And also, especially in the case of Kenya, also was predictive, for example, indirectly about possibilities of further problems. The piece on Yugoslavia, for example, also because Markovic has very, of course, direct knowledge about the history, but also about the texts in their original language. A lot of people have seen them in translation, but we needed somebody who knows the connotations and the very nuances of the language, how it's used. That was crucial, and I think we were very fortunate in having this number of really bright intellectuals who are also sufficiently detached from the surrounding to give an objective narrative, but also sufficiently aware of the nuances and the histories to also give an in-depth insight in what was going on.
Mm-hmm. And one of the things I found really admirable and striking about the book is the selection of authors, not just from a variety of disciplinary perspectives, but from a variety of cultural and geographic backgrounds. And the book has essays on some of the kind of canonical events in genocide or study of mass violence, but it also talks about, as you say, Nigeria, some of the places which are less commonly referred to. What was your purpose in kind of thinking about the selection of topics?
Yes, I think that the old traditional cases of genocide have been overstudied, mm-hmm. and probably most of the insights that already could be garnered from them has been there. And so we wanted to bring a little bit of a wider angle, to look at a wider angle. India, for example, we're lucky to have my colleague here, Dibish Annan. Yeah. Who was very also insightful in about how the narrative of demonization and the insecurity plays together as usual in these cases. Self-aggrandizement and also insecurity. Usually this is what we have seen with the Nazis and others, that usually these narratives either show the Aryan race, for example, as invincible, but at the same time completely insecure and facing danger from very marginalized groups. We see this in India. We've seen this a little bit in the Nigerian case. Iraq, of course, is a different case, which is, I think, is a classical case about how the insecurity of the regime there has driven violence to unprecedented levels, but then generated insecurities among groups and between groups. So I think the wider angle and the number of new cases was very important addition to bring new insights. So we had the focus on narratives and the side and the focus on new cases. Both of them, hopefully, should bring very important new insights to genocide studies.
I have to say, I very much enjoyed the book, and I learned a lot from it. All of the essays were wonderful. I, as you pointed to the Nigerian one, I was especially struck by that essay. But we've taken a lot of your time, so I just ask you a couple kind of concluding questions that I try to ask the authors I have on the show. And the first one is to give you a chance. Is there a book or something about the subject, whether it's an academic book or a memoir or maybe a film or something. What should somebody stop what they're doing now that they're done listening to the podcast and go find at the library? What would you suggest?
Well, first, watch The Matrix. I think that's a brilliant piece about how, for example, you can find terrorism to glorify terrorism and show that it is really the terrorist as hero or the one, as they put it. When you portray really the situation as one which, if you are looking from that perspective, how you could really construct a world where violence and terrorism would be really the way. Books-wise, I think Omar Bartov's Mirrors of Destruction is really insightful. And also Jack Simmelin's Purify and Destroy. Both of them actually touch on many of the important issues we looked at here, especially about a construction of victims and about how maybe narratives, they might not have gone as far as we have done in showing that narratives themselves are central, but they also look at that way narratives and how people see their world by or narrativize their world.
Excellent. And last, what are you working on now?
Two things at the moment. A small project I'm working on now is about religion and violence in Africa, which I'm going to present next April at a conference for the African Union. In book-wise, I'm returning to the central issue I started with about terrorism and violence, and especially in the Arab political system, the fate of Arab democracy after the spring, now that it has been engulfed in so much really violence, which was unimaginable even before the spring, but is more unimaginable after it. And I'm trying to really go in depth to explain why have we sunk so low after going so high.
Well, that sounds like a fascinating project, and I look forward to reading it. And I want to say thank you for agreeing to do the interview. I was very interested in what you had to say. And as I say, I look forward to what you're doing next.
Thank you very much, Kelly. I really enjoyed it.
You've been listening to an interview with Abdelwahab El-Effendi about his edited collection of essays entitled Genocidal Nightmares, Narratives of Insecurity and the Logic of Mass Atrocity. If you enjoyed this interview, you can listen to previous podcasts through iTunes, or from the webpage for New Books in Genocide Studies, part of the New Books Network of podcasts. I hope you'll come back next time when I'll talk with Daniel Feierstein about his new book titled Genocide as Social Practice, Reorganizing Society Under the Nazis and Argentina's Military Junta. In the meantime, thanks for the download and have a great month.